Welcome to the Primordial Soup Pod. My name is Aaron.
And I'm Rustin.
Every 2 weeks, Russ and I get together to discuss topics in the field of ecology, natural history, and evolution. And this week, we got our Christmas episode.
Hell yeah. Love a Christmas episode.
Nothing says ecology like a, you know, man-made holiday. How did you find the research for this one?
Pretty straightforward, actually. You'll understand once my topic comes around, but it's not exactly a niche topic.
Is it pine trees?
It is not pine trees. I can tell you okay. That.
I thought you were teeing me up for it.
But it is similarly ubiquitous in Christmas culture.
Okay, I think I have a good guess.
I think you do. But you're up first, so why don't you get to it?
Okay, so when we think of Christmas time, we usually think of snow, pine trees, reindeer, mistletoe, and what have you. I mean, this is in December, and for a large part of the world, that is winter time. But Christmas is not just celebrated in the Northern Hemisphere. It's widespread. It's in Africa, Australia, Asia, and South America. So I decided to focus on events that occur in the summertime in these regions, which is still Christmas time, but, you know, Southern Hemisphere, so it's flipped. And I eventually settled on the aptly named Christmas Island red crabs. Have you heard of these?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, I figured you had. So I'll go over a bit about the island and the crabs in general, and then I'll focus on their migration and some of the obstacles that they face. So a little background on Christmas Island. This is a small island located in the Indian Ocean. It's about 135 square kilometers or just 50 square miles. Despite its relative closeness to Java and Sumatra, it's only about 190 nautical miles. It's actually part of Australia, which is way further away. The island is called Christmas Island because it was named by Captain William Mynors on Christmas Day, 1643. Interestingly enough, unlike many islands, a good portion of its wildlife remained intact over the centuries, despite it not being super isolated, because it was just never really inhabited by people, or it was not inhabited by people until the late 1800s.
Sorry, I just want to back up for a bit. You said this island was called Christmas Island because some European guy landed on the island on Christmas?
I don't think he actually landed there on Christmas. I think he just named it that day.
Oh, okay. Well, still, you're saying that that's why it's called Christmas Island? That's pretty ridiculous.
I'm guessing they hit a lot of islands that day, and you know, they're running out of names.
But think about it. If you and I went and discovered a new island and couldn't decide what to name it, and eventually decided on the name of that island could be Talk Like a Pirate Island, or like Labor Island, or something like that.
Or even worse, Easter Island. Who would name an island that?
See? You're getting it. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, so it was never inhabited by people until the late 1800s when British explorers established a colony there, which I guess technically means this is like one of the few places in the Pacific Ocean where white British people are indigenous, if they got there first. Like, if they're the first ones to set up shop, no one else was using it.
As far as people go, yes.
Yeah, it's, you don't get a lot of that.
No.
Now, Pitcairn Island, that's another example. Which was like, it was like a population of like 13 people they established there.
I didn't know that was a thing. That's really not, I didn't expect that to be a thing outside of Europe.
Well, I mean, a lot of these islands are kind of not inhabited for a reason. They're tiny, you know, no one really wants to be there.
Except for some people on Christmas, that is.
Except for some people on Christmas and a lot of crabs. So over the years, more people settled on the island. It has a population of just under 2,000. To put in perspective how small it is, the capital city was once known as simply just the settlement. Like, that was it. It was just the capital city was the settlement. And then it was named Fly Fisher after one of the only boats that would routinely visit the settlement.
Wow, these were some of the least creative people I've ever heard of.
I mean, it's like naming your capital city like Boeing 747 because that's the only thing that's flying in there.
Seriously, or like Amtrak or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So not a big island. It is a decent mix of cultures. English, Chinese, Australian, Malaysian, and Indians being some of the main demographics there. But of course, being an island has a lot of unique wildlife. So there's plenty of tropical seabirds and bats as well. Interestingly, it actually did have a few small mammals. A lot of these islands don't. It actually had two species of rat and one species of shrew. Again, typically rats aren't native to these islands, and when rats do show up, they cause a lot of trouble. But in this case, they were actually already there.
Hiding chef hats, making omelets, doing their thing.
Doing rat things, yeah. But, you know, rather than like a giant tortoise or flightless birds, this island had a different dominant terrestrial group, crabs. The majority of the land animals on this island are crabs. They just adapted to live on land. This ranges from like tiny little shore crabs to the massive coconut crabs, if you've ever seen them before.
Only in my nightmares, but continue.
They're a little freaky looking. The Christmas Island red crab is not as freaky as the coconut crab. It's one of the most common species on the island. It's bright red with kind of a dark purple pattern on its back. It's kind of your standard land crab build. It's about 5 inches across or 12 centimeters. The scientific name is G. Carcodia natalis. I don't know what it translates to. I believe the natalis, which technically translates to baby, is actually a reference to birthday or Christmas. And I don't know what the genus means. I can't answer that. But these crabs are some of the largest native land animals on the island, because there's not really any native land animals. They are omnivores and feed on a variety of prey. This includes leaves, fruits, corpses, smaller crabs, trash, and small invertebrates. They're active in the daytime, where they have few predators. But most avoid direct sunlight because they do still have gills. Even though they live on land, they have to keep these gills moist to breathe. So they will live in burrows and hunker down during the dry season. And then they come out where they can find the shady spot. It's similar to an amphibian. They gotta have some sort of moisture point to live. But during the rainy season, these crabs migrate towards the sea to breed. Millions of them all marching toward the sea at once. And I look up pictures of this. It is insane. The amount of crabs just marching to the sea. And they're not tiny crabs. They're about 5 inches across, which is comparable to a blue crab.
Yeah. Yeah. That is actually the legal minimum size for harvesting blue crabs in the state of Maryland.
Okay, so imagine the legal minimum for blue crabs, just tons of them, walking towards the sea.
Way to make this bit as Maryland as possible, Aaron.
Hey, it's my home turf, I gotta represent. So this begins usually in October and November, and lasts about a week. The male crabs will leave first, and they take about a week to arrive. They leave their burrows in the forest and make their way towards the coast. They usually avoid traveling midday when it's hottest. And they only do this in the rainy season because, like I said, they're land crabs, but they still have gills. You know, gotta stay moist. They can cover up to 4 kilometers or 2.5 miles. They won't go much further than this because the island really isn't that big. Interestingly enough, the bigger the crab, the further inland they will live, and thus the further they will walk. And these crabs will actually start early to arrive at the same time as all the other males. Sometimes the males will actually stop and eat and just wait for all the other crabs to catch up and then keep moving. So all these crabs need to arrive at the same time. They can't get a head start and just arrive early. One theory for this is that there's not really any food on the beach. So if you're a crab and you want to show up a week early, that's just another week you got to go without food. So if everyone's breeding at this one time, you might as well all show up at the same time. It doesn't benefit you to hunker down early.
Kind of like a nightclub, you know. You really want to be there when there are other people there. Showing up to an empty nightclub is kind of pointless.
I remember going to a club once. It was, okay, to be fair, it was like 6:45. And it was just the four of us in there. Completely empty. I went to use the bathroom and I see vomit from the night before. Or the early morning before, beer cans everywhere, clogged toilets and urinals. And I said, guys, let's go. I don't want to come back here. And then someone left their purse there and we had to double back inside. pretty much after we blew everyone off and said, hey, we're not coming back here. We have to, hey, let us in again. So similar to that, how they navigate is still not known. Some theories involve lunar cycles or watching the sun. Since these crabs typically move in the shade, that might be a little harder to follow. These crabs will make a straight shot more or less, but in more urbanized areas, not that there are a ton, it's not a big island, they tend to stick to the shade, often walking along the road as much as possible before crossing in the open sun. Another theory is that the young crabs, the young males, will actually wait for the older male crabs to move, and then they kind of follow them, and they learn this migration pattern by just watching the adults. Again, not fully known, but one way or another, they make their way down to the water. The male crabs will construct burrows by the shore, and this is where mating will occur. They'll guard their burrows from other males while the females arrive, and then the males fight and compete over them. When the female selects a mate, she moves into his burrow, they do the deed, and then she'll remain to guard the fertilized eggs. Each female can lay up to 100,000 eggs. So, you know, multiply that with several million female crabs, and you get a lot of baby crabs.
Sure. But then again, what's the survival rate there?
It ain't good. It is not good. So the males will ditch the females at this point back to the forest. The females remain the burrows for about 2 weeks. Then they move to the water and they release all their young. The young are planktonic at this stage and known as megalopa. They kind of look more like shrimp than crabs at this point, and there are billions of them. And just like what you said, for a good reason, virtually everything eats them. They're kind of small and helpless. That's why the females have so many. You know, pump out a couple hundred thousand, maybe six of them make it to adulthood.
Yeah, the spray and pray approach, if you will.
Exactly. We're doing quantity over quality here. They're eaten by all sorts of small fish and filter feeders. Virtually, it's free food for almost anything. They're tiny. Everything's going to take advantage of it. Actually, some protected species like manta rays or whale sharks will also feed on them. These crabs can make up a very important, albeit seasonal, part of their diet. And after about 3 weeks in the ocean, the crabs will walk back onto land. The surviving crabs will walk back on the land, super tiny, only about 0.2 inches or 5 millimeters. And they'll cover the beach like a swarm of ants. And like we mentioned, this is a mere fraction of the total number of crabs. One park official in an article said that it's not uncommon for virtually all of them to be eaten in a year. Thankfully, these crabs can live for several years, so one bad year won't end them all. So they make their way back on the land with millions of these tiny crabs marching home. With time, a few will grow into adulthood, and 4 to 5 years later, they join the migration back to the sea. And to tie it in with Christmas, this crab migration can happen at Christmas time. So the adults typically move, or the males leave first in October or November. It's not unheard of for them to delay this migration till December, because it's got to coincide with the rainy season. And they still got to march back a few weeks later, and then the females got to come down, the females have to march back, and then the babies got to march back on the land also. So it is very much possible to see a cast of these Christmas Island crabs marching around on Christmas Island on Christmas Day. And they do celebrate Christmas on Christmas Island, too. So you don't get a white Christmas, you get a little crabby one.
You get a red Christmas.
A red Christmas. Yeah, I even heard one person call it a red tide event. Not to be confused with the ecological disaster known as a red tide. Right. This one's good. It's crabs. We like them.
Yeah, exactly. Especially here in Maryland. But I've seen footage of this, and I honestly hadn't seen a red wave that big or frightening since The Shining.
I never saw The Shining. Wasn't it like it flew out of, or it came out of like a hotel room?
Yes, and it like flooded a whole hallway.
Okay, yeah, I saw that bit.
Yeah.
Imagine that with crabs, and that's really what you're getting into here.
The same scene, but imagine the water is sharp and has claws.
Yeah. Now, the young crabs, of course, are eaten by all sorts of animals, but the adults have very few natural predators. The crabs will cannibalize, but this is usually restricted to just dead or dying individuals. It's not like they're attacking each other all the time. Coconut crabs will occasionally feed on them, but beyond that, they don't really have many predators. And you know how I mentioned there are two species of rat on the island? They're actually extinct now. The native rats of this island are extinct, which is, you know, usually they're trying to get rid of rats on an island. It's thought that these rats might have actually predated on them. And interestingly enough, historical accounts rarely mention these massive crab migrations. So it's possible their population was much smaller in the past. And, you know, without the rats to keep them in check, their population kind of boomed. And while some species, like invasive brown rats or domestic cats, might impact them a little bit, the main issue they face in terms of predation is the yellow crazy ant. Have you heard of these?
No.
Okay, so these are an invasive species of ant spread throughout many tropical countries. They're invasive everywhere. They have quickly overrun Christmas Island, and they have accounted for anywhere from 10 to 60 million crab deaths over the years, depending on which source you're going off of. They've been there, I believe, for about 100 years, but they weren't even really prominent until the 80s or 90s.
Damn, they're responsible for more crab deaths than Old Bay.
Yes, they are. So, interestingly enough, these ants, they don't really bite, but they spray formic acid when they're disturbed. And when the crabs march over their colonies, they get sprayed. And it can get so bad that it chokes the crabs out. It's difficult for them to breathe. And they're constantly trying to wash their gills off by, you know, sort of salivating. And this can actually dehydrate them and they just die on the spot. They just get exhausted from being covered in acid. I mean, I probably would too. I don't think I'd enjoy it either if I was covered in acid. And then the ants will eat the dead crabs. So it's not too dissimilar from Old Bay. You know, it's really tangy seasoning. That's really all they're doing. Let it sun dry a little bit, and you got lemony crab jerky.
Yeah. Surf with Natty Bo, and you're good.
Woohoo. And these ants are not just a threat to the crabs. This is a widespread problem across the globe. Christmas Island is probably where they're at their worst, but they're found everywhere. Studies have found that ants occupy about 25% of Christmas Island, and the areas they inhabit tend to have almost no crabs at all. Like, these guys are just not compatible.
And the ants are spreading?
They are spreading, yeah. Actually, I remember there is this, I don't know if it was actually Animal Planet, it might have been Discovery, but they called it Monster Bug Battles. And it was so cheesy. They would bring on two experts, and the experts would talk about what features the two bugs have in a fight. But 99% of the time, it was just some stock footage of a praying mantis catching a fly. And they try and make it seem like it's an even fight. Like, oh, the fly's got agility in this one. There's a video. I remember this. I'm pretty sure it's one of these crabs. And it walks onto like an ant colony. And they're making it sound like, oh, well, the crab's got strong pinchers going up against a million ants. I wonder who's going to win this one. And they add like a stock footage Godzilla monster sounds, like roaring. They're probably still on YouTube somewhere.
Probably, yeah. It's like that age old question, a trillion lions or the sun?
It's literally that. Like, unless you can throw enough islands or enough lions at the sun to somehow. Wait, no, it's not like that at all. The crab's not winning this. The crab is not winning this at all.
Right. And neither are the lions. They're going up against the sun.
I thought you're making it sound like the sun was the crab just because he's bigger.
No.
Yeah, it's no contest here.
Yeah, and neither is it a contest for the sun.
Besides the yellow crazy ants, humans also pose a big threat. These crabs are not eaten. I read one, it was interesting, it was an anthropology paper. So hard to research this. Why put paywalls on papers? I'm coming back to this again. It's ridiculous. I can't read the papers that are actually cited, like in the journal entries, like in newspaper articles. I want to read the proper paper. Shouldn't have to pirate them.
Every episode. Paywalls are dumb. Yeah.
Anyways, I found an anthropology paper, and I just read it because I thought maybe it offers some insight. And apparently the crabs were never eaten, but they were used as chicken feed. The babies were. At one point, the eggs were coming out kind of red from eating all the baby crabs. I don't think this is true. I guess they had red eggs there. Anyways, the issue is just infrastructure. As you can imagine, cars were killing a significant number, thousands of crabs every year, because they're covering the roads, the streets, everywhere. if you got to get from point A to point B, how do you not step on a crab?
Yeah, I don't know.
And while this is a small island, you can't just walk everywhere. The streets are literally filled with crabs. They're going to get hit by cars. Other issues just include buildings. So crabs don't necessarily have the best time when there's suddenly a new house where the usual path goes through. Sometimes it gets stuck. There's a little video I watched and they wandered in the stairwells. They were like climbing people's front porch in the windowsill. They're not the best at getting around. And open areas like roads and lawns prove a huge threat to them because without tree coverage, they can just dry up too quickly and die.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Roads, of course, that's a double whammy. You got to watch out for cars and it's super hot. You know, the sun's beating out on it directly.
And also it's asphalt too, right?
Yeah, it's asphalt too. So that's, you know, it's going to cook you, really. That's all it's doing. And then the lawns, it's sad, but it's kind of funny. Just imagine you want to, it's like a perfectly mowed little lawn and just crabs keep dying in it every year. It's going to stink.
Imagine that being the reason why you keep a rake in your garage. Not because of leaves, because, you know, you're on a tropical island and leaves don't fall, but because of crabs that cover your lawn once a year.
The crabs, yeah. Well, I guess the leaves wouldn't fall. It's a tropical island. So yeah, it literally would just be a crab.
That's the only reason you have a rake.
There are two big problems that need to be addressed here. Ants need to be controlled and humans and crabs need to coexist. Everyone's got to play along. Multiple studies have focused on the ants. Like I said, this is a widespread problem, not just Christmas Island, across the globe, many tropical countries. So some studies have focused on using pesticides, but applied them in extremely specific points on top of their super colonies. And they do this in the dry season when the crabs are in their burrows to avoid harming them. Of course, this has risk to the rest of the wildlife in the area. But they have some advancements in using drones who track the crab's movement and apply precise pesticide applications so it can minimize the damage to everything but the ants.
Alternatively, you could do that thing where you just pour molten aluminum into the ant colony.
There's like a guy with a whole YouTube channel for that. Just book him for a season.
Honestly.
He'll make a lot of content.
It might not be effective, but it's sure going to look cool.
It's entertaining at the very least.
Definitely. Especially when the crazy ant starts spraying his ankles and he has to run away screaming. Because you know that guy doesn't wear shoes. You've seen the videos. He walks up to a fire ant colony barefoot holding a cask of molten aluminum with no shoes on. I don't even know where to begin with the safety violations.
You know, if he can handle fire ants, I bet he could deal with crazy ants.
But they're crazy ants, Aaron. They're crazy.
They're called crazy ants just because they kind of run around sporadically. Yeah, so the pesticide route is very expensive, of course, and it's only a temporary fix. I mean, you got to keep nailing them. It's not a full-time solution. Other work focuses on reducing scale insects, which feed on sap and excrete honeydew. This is actually the main food source for the yellow crazy ants.
Okay.
The crazy ants tend to kill off most wildlife, but they have actually increased the scale insect numbers by guarding them. In turn, this actually leads to deforestation. So this is a more long-lasting solution in reducing the ants. Some are looking into parasitoid wasps to reduce their numbers and just releasing them as like a biological control. This is still ongoing research, of course, but it seems like, at least for Christmas Island, the most effective route is to control the ants' food source. And then as an added bonus, you're also protecting the forests. In terms of people, several projects have been launched to better help the crabs coexist with people. And most people on the island seem to be pro-crab. I'm sure there's a couple old people that, you know, talk about like, back in my day, the crabs were more polite. I don't know. Something like that. There's always going to be one guy.
They weren't on their phones all day. They didn't walk around flipping everybody off. They used to say please and thank you.
There's always that one guy in a town hall meeting.
They went to church on Sunday.
I worked in a state park, and a guy called one time from a completely different state park that was not answering his calls, and he kept asking for their contact info, and I gave him like the number on the website. He's like, no, that one's not good. They won't pick up. And he said, I'm going to give the message to you, and you got to pass it along. Go up the chain of command. I said, okay. He said, I'm here to report unlawful yoga activity. He just said, there's hundreds of these guys, and I'm trying to get a photo with my family, and they're all doing yoga in the background. And I just kind of like, okay, you know, I just roll along with it. And he's like, I keep telling them to leave so I can get a photo with my family. It's like, this dude is just screaming at people doing yoga.
Aaron, it's a public health emergency. People are peacefully stretching. We got to put a stop to this now.
That message needs to go up the chain. Yeah, poor yoga people. You know what? I'm pretty sure they were there first, too. Like,
right. It's not like this guy decided to take a picture and then like a bunch of people in yoga pants came out and were like, all right, now, guys, now. We got to ruin the
now,
picture.
Now, get him. Downward dog, quickly.
And swiftly into Warrior 2 before he notices.
And it wasn't even the same park. His park was like 2 hours away from mine. Just no one at that park cared at all. Anyway, so I imagine there's one or two people like that, except with the crabs. But right. Most people seem to be pro-crab. There's actually a good amount of volunteers that will come, and literally what you just said, they rake them off the road, or they brush them. They kind of gently move them to the side so that cars can slowly pass through. And they'll also shut down roads altogether if it's particularly bothersome. I mean, this is not a big island. There's probably only so many roads.
Yeah.
Saw a video where there's kids going to school, and the bus just... it would take them a certain distance and stop, and the kids got out and walked the rest of the distance, which may be a little annoying, but at least the weather's nice. They also will set up curved sheet metal along the road to kind of funnel the crabs in specific areas. So it's like that one lady on the radio show that called about the deer crossing and said, why don't you move the deer crossing to areas where there's less people so we don't hit them? Because she thought the deer crossing signs were for the deers. So I guess it actually does work in this case. You're directing the crabs into other areas.
That reminds me of that. Have you ever seen the clips of that one news host on C-SPAN who's just fielding open calls from random people who are watching C-SPAN? And these people are just saying the dumbest, most asinine things you can possibly imagine. And at the end of every single call, he goes, all right. Thank you for your call. Next.
The soul is just slowly leaving that guy's body.
Right. Seriously, the most he will ever do is maybe like lightly correct them. So I'm sorry, sir, but we cannot control the weather. Thank you for your call.
It's like Parks and Rec whenever they like the town hall.
It's exactly like that. Her daughter is an idiot. Her daughter is an idiot.
It's exactly like that. Anyways, yeah, so the crabs are moved to more controlled areas. Of course, you know, crabs are going to get everywhere, but it's at least better. But the most famous project is the crab bridges. These kind of resemble monkey bars, and they stretch over the roads with metal grates on the sides and top. At the end of each bridge, they set up those metal sidings I mentioned to sort of funnel the crabs toward the bridge where they can safely cross over the road without risk of becoming roadkill. In other areas, they do the opposite, and they actually do like a crab tunnel, where they will dig out a section of road, replace the top with a grate, and then they kind of got this little drainage pipe where the crabs can just walk on underneath. Then, of course, we get to why are these crabs important. First of all, they're cool. You know, like,
yeah, so
I'm very much a fan of animals need to be conserved strictly because I find them interesting, and I want other people to be around and see how interesting they are.
Yeah, that's fair.
But these crabs are, in fact, a keystone species in two major aspects. So on land, they manage the forest. They eat seeds of a wide variety of weeds. This allows the taller trees to flourish, so the saplings can develop better in areas with these crabs. They construct burrows other wildlife can use. They churn soil, and of course, they excrete poop, fertilize it. And right. They consume a vast number of dead leaves. About 30 to 50% of all leaves on the island get eaten by these crabs, and convert into waste for other plants to use. So that's a very important part in nutrient cycling. They are crucial to the health of the forest. And conveniently, even if you ignore all of that, these crabs like to eat a certain species of stinging weed. So as the crabs decline, this weed becomes more plentiful. So even like if you ignore all of that, keep them around just to like not worry about getting stung on the ankle.
Seriously, if I found out that there was a crab around here that ate poison ivy, do you know how quickly I would want that crab to flourish?
Also, they keep other invasive species in check, like the African giant landsnail. That's another pretty widespread invasive species. Crabs love them. I mean, they're just easy targets. They will just pluck them right out of the shell and eat them. And in the water, it's like a completely different story where the young act as a food source for countless young fish and large planktivores. Like I said, manta rays, whale sharks. Those are both protected species, and they're very impressive to see in person. Not that I have, but I imagine it would be. So it's kind of rare where you get a species that is a keystone species, and it performs two completely different roles at two different points of its life. You don't see that too often.
No. No.
But besides that, how are the Christmas Island red crabs doing overall? I couldn't really find an official rating on their status. They did see a pretty big decline in numbers when the yellow ants reached their peak. Like I said, this could be anywhere from 10 to 20 to 60 million, depending on the source. The crabs have more or less been accepted by the locals. You can find merchandise and souvenirs on the island. And like I said, I'm sure it gets annoying when one's stuck in your stairwell. I believe the average person is generally pro-crab. At least in the videos I watched, they were. And I'm pretty sure, I couldn't prove this, but the crabs from the Crab Rave music video were inspired by the Christmas Island Red Crabs, which was a very popular song in our friend group in college.
It was the best.
Which, if you haven't seen it, involves a bunch of red crabs resembling the Christmas Island crab walking to the shore and dancing. Yep. And, you know, the crabs do all march to the shore in large numbers. They don't dance, but close enough.
Maybe they don't dance because there's no techno music in the background, Aaron. Did you think of that?
No, that would really amp up tourism. So the crabs are protected and have clear ecological benefits to the island. On top of this, they provide a great opportunity for revenue. Christmas Island has never really had a huge industry over the years. It had a phosphate mine for a while, and I believe it still serves as an immigration detention center for Australia. But these red crabs put this otherwise overlooked island on the map. So lots of money is going to protecting these crabs. In fact, the majority of this island is just one big nature reserve, over 60%.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Not that it's a big island, but still.
Yes. Yeah. No. That's
so protecting these crabs, I believe, well, in turn benefits all the wildlife of the island. But ecotourism definitely seems like the way forward for this, especially with how popular and spectacular these crabs are. I mean, consider this. Everyone goes on vacation for Christmas. Look on Instagram, you see pine trees, snowy fields, a warm fireplace. You know, maybe someone took a trip to Alaska, Yellowstone, or overseas to France. Well, everyone's doing that. You're on Christmas Island. Christmas Day, you're just surrounded by tons of crabs.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. I would go see these in a heartbeat.
Honestly, that'd be a great Instagram post. You just like take a picture of you with like a wave of crabs in the background, and then the caption just reads something like Mele Kalikimaka.
It's the wrong island.
Close enough. It's
they're not close at all. They're not even the same ocean.
It's a tropical island on Christmas, though. The spirit is the same. It's Christmas, man. It's all about the vibes.
They speak Mandarin on the island. You walk up to any of them, they're not going to know what that means.
All right, well, maybe you look it up in a different language. I don't know.
Still, I get the point. Like, this should be, I think there's a good opportunity for ecotourism. And if you look online, there's tons of little documentaries on these crabs. They're very interesting.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that.
Anyways, that is my piece on the Christmas Island red crabs.
Oh. Lovely. Lovely. Instead of doing a topic about them a couple different times for different episodes, like we did an episode on crabs a while back, and I thought about doing the Christmas Island crabs for that one. But
yeah, they can fit a lot of different categories.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's not a super unknown one. I think most people don't know about them, but videos and pictures of them migrating are fairly famous.
Right. Yeah, they're very striking for sure.
Oh, yeah, they're bright red. And you see millions of them crossing the road. You know, you don't see that every day.
No, definitely not.
All right. What do you got for me?
Okay. So when we think of Christmas, there are a select few plants and animals that usually come to mind, either because they're featured in a carol or some other kind of Christmas media. You know, you got Rudolph and the reindeer pulling Santa's sleigh. You got spruce trees in your living room. Personally, I associate hippos with Christmas because of one song, you know, I Want a Hippopotamus for Christmas. Longtime listeners will know that the song sounds like it was written about Pablo Escobar, but I digress. An example of this type of phenomenon is mistletoe.
I figured you were going with mistletoe.
Yeah, you knew where I was going with this.
Especially when you said plants. You led with plants first, plants and animals. And we don't talk about plants on here too much.
True, true. In fact, we've done a couple episodes just about plants because we don't talk about plants enough. But
we've done it twice, and both times we convened on the same sort of group of plants.
It's funny how that works anyway. Great minds think alike and all that. No, we're going to be talking about a plant for at least the second half of this episode, and that plant will be mistletoe. Most people know the deal with mistletoe around the holidays. You know, you stick it in a corner of the ceiling of your living room, and you force people to kiss, and you kickstart the plot of a romantic comedy in the process. It's a truly fascinating plant group with some important ecosystem functions that I really want to get into. When most people think of mistletoe, they think of like this green-leafed plant with white or red berries that hangs from a tree. And that is actually mistletoe, don't get me wrong, but it's far from the only kind of mistletoe. The particular varieties that inhabit pop culture around the holidays are really only a few species that are native to North America and Europe. There are actually over 1,000 species of mistletoe found throughout the world on every continent. And you know what phrase usually comes after on every continent, right?
Except Antarctica.
Yeah, except Antarctica.
We don't get much of anything in Antarctica.
True enough. And definitely not mistletoe, as it turns out. But what people may or may not know is that all these species, regardless of where they are found, are parasites. Or more accurately, they're known as hemiparasites. And if that sounds confusing, don't worry, I'll explain how all this works.
There's got to be like some country where they just hang tapeworms from the wall. It's like tinsel. Party strangers.
Why?
It's a parasite.
It's so different from mistletoe. So different.
Okay, well,
that makes no sense.
Well, it could be an external parasite then.
The only reason I can think you would do that is to prove that you're parasite free. Like, you hang it on the wall and you're like, here, this was inside me. It's no longer inside me.
Ooh, hey, the doctor got him.
I'm cured. It's okay, guys. We can celebrate. But other than that, no. That's not a good idea. Anyway, mistletoe species aren't rooted in the ground. Instead, their seeds germinate once they land on a branch or another part of a host plant. From there, a part of the mistletoe called the haustorium, begins penetrating the host with the help of digestive enzymes. Now, this part of the mistletoe is where the root of a normal plant would typically be. It can take many different forms depending on the host and the species of mistletoe. Many of these haustorium formations are highly specialized, which is typical of parasites, right? They tend to specialize in one or two kinds of host. As a side note, some haustorium types penetrate a tree by causing it to create like a weird frilly formation through which the haustorium can then enter. These formations are called wood roses and are used to create some really awesome wood carvings in many parts of the world. Take the branch with like this really weird formation and turn it into like a fish or a frog or something. And
that is cool.
It's actually really awesome.
I gotta derail you for a sec though. Haustorium, this sounds like a old timey haunted house.
It kind of does, like Victoria, yeah. Era,
I made a trick to the haustorium today. Some good October frights.
I came back with urine on my leg. It was a jolly good time.
Haunted houses were different back then.
Anyway.
Special effect budget was a bit lower.
Anyway, so the haustorium eventually taps into the plumbing of the host plant, specifically tubes within the structure of the plant that are called xylem, which carry water. The mistletoe then begins to siphon off some of the water, so that the mistletoe can use it to grow. So it sounds pretty parasitic so far, right? Not at all partially parasitic. Well, they aren't pure parasites, as it turns out, because they still photosynthesize to produce their own nutrients and food.
I thought you were going to say they felt bad about it.
No.
Hey, I don't enjoy it, pal, but I got to do it.
Right. So they just get some unwilling help from their host in the form of water that they steal. It's like the plant equivalent of an upstanding citizen that works a normal job at a bank who also has a side hustle robbing banks. Like I said, they don't rely solely on the hosts for food. They're known as hemiparasites, right? They create their own nutrients and food, so they're not full parasites. The leaves of the mistletoe will then gradually spread out from its foothold on the tree and produce food for the plant as it grows. Eventually, the mistletoe will flower and produce seeds, often in the form of small fruits or berries. Although some species will have like exploding pods that will spread seeds across to other trees and branches. Usually they're berries, though. And these berries are often eaten by birds, many of which specialize in eating mistletoe fruits. These berries are really, really nutritious. They're high in sugar and a lot of other nutrients. Some of them even contain 10 of the 20 amino acids. So it's a really great bang for your buck if you're a bird or any other type of animal that's looking for a quick snack.
Sounds like you're selling me into like an MLM.
Seriously.
Right here. It's got 10 of the 20 amino acids. You got to get this berry juice.
Right. It's how people in the Andes live for hundreds of years. Anyway, so the seeds of the mistletoe will pass through the digestive tract of the animal, usually bird, are then deposited back onto another host with the help of a sticky layer of goo. And so the process begins all over again. The haustorium penetrates the host, and we have a new mistletoe plant. While they are hemiparasites, which cheat the system and steal water from their hosts, it's worth noting that mistletoe plays an important role in ecosystems. Or I mentioned above that animals or birds eat their fruits, and some specialize in it, but I didn't really get into how deep this goes, because there's some pretty cool stuff here. There's actually one species of bird in Australia called the mistletoe bird, which specializes in eating these berries. The bird has really evolved a really close mutualistic relationship with mistletoe, because they have evolved to pass the seed of the mistletoe more quickly than most other birds. And when they do eventually poop out the seed, the bird makes sure to place the seed on another tree branch. And it does this by doing a kind of little booty shake to make sure the seed gets in the right position. It's kind of funny, actually. They're like planting future mistletoe plants, so it's pretty cool. Furthermore, the flowers of some mistletoe plants are important sources of nectar for insects and birds, like the hummingbirds I talked about in the last episode. Many other bird species use the leaves and branches of the mistletoe as a nesting location because they have really dense foliage that hides their nests really well. Furthermore, the mistletoe grows and dies relatively quickly compared to its host, so its leaves and branches will fall and decompose, which help to recycle nutrients and water back into the ecosystem. This process was actually called, quote, a dripping tap of fertilizer by one scientist who studied mistletoe. That is an exact quote.
That's a good name for it.
Yeah, honestly. One study actually removed the mistletoe plants from a forest in Australia and found that a quarter of all the bird species left the mistletoe-free area. There are a lot of birds that really rely on these mistletoe plants for shelter and food.
Yeah, no kidding. Maybe we shouldn't be plucking them for Christmas time.
Yeah, maybe. It's also worth noting that most of the host species that mistletoe inhabits aren't economically important species. They do parasitize some pine trees and the like, but mostly it's just, you know, your standard oak trees and things like that. So the presence of the mistletoe doesn't usually affect humans economically, and they usually aren't harmful enough to actually kill the tree.
So just benefits across the board, really.
Seriously. Sure, the tree loses some water, but it's really helpful for a lot of other organisms. And so even though mistletoe is kind of, even though it is a parasite, it's a really important parasite for the functioning of a lot of these ecosystems. There have even been a couple of ecologists who've argued that mistletoe is a keystone species in some areas because of how many important functions it has. And that's pretty much the overview of the biology of the mistletoe, which I found really interesting. But since it is the Christmas episode, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the whole kissing thing. And I'm sure you're wondering where the hell that came from.
Is this something the birds did?
Nope. You have any other guesses?
It was fun. I don't know.
No. So the whole kissing thing dates back to 18th century England, although it isn't known exactly how the tradition itself developed. So that part is still a mystery. Your guess is as good as mine, is as good as the next historian's. But we know it was during this time because at the beginning of this century, there was an extensive report on mistletoe written, which did not mention kissing at all. So it clearly wasn't a thing back then. And by the end of the century, it was everywhere, including these art prints, which mentioned a servant named, and I quote, Saucy Joe, who hid under the mistletoe in an attempt to kiss Bridget the cook. It seems this whole thing could have started with Saucy Joe, and that's why
people... Saucy Joe, you've done it again.
And that's why people kiss under the mistletoe. All thanks to Saucy Joe.
That's going in the title.
I figured it would. And so from there, the tradition migrated to America and then to the rest of the world as Christmas tradition spread.
Wait, so he just like pulled it out of his ass. He's like, oh, there's a mistletoe. You got to kiss me. I mean, like, he could have grabbed anything. If he was, like, setting the trend, he could have grabbed, like, a handful of slugs. He's like, oh, you know what that means.
Well, so, I did also read that people would pick mistletoe and hang it from their doors or in their homes as decoration. But there weren't really any direct links between that and the tradition of kissing under the mistletoe. So,
okay,
we don't really know about that. But, hey, at least we're not kissing under tapeworms, because that would be gross.
Well, all right, if it had to be a decoration, then you know how like ceramic pineapples were like extremely trendy for millennials to put in their home? Everywhere. Imagine someone's like, oh, here's the pineapple. You know what that means?
Yep.
Or I got a stack of potpourri. Come here.
Yeah. No, I'm glad it's mistletoe, though. Brings more recognition to a really, really cool group of plants, at least in my opinion.
It is a cool group of plants.
Another fun fact about the mistletoe is that apparently people have known about how their seeds were distributed for a while because the word mistletoe comes from the combination of two old English words, which literally mean dung twig. So people have known for a while that mistletoe spread through poop.
So have a smooch under the poop stick?
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, it's Saucy Joe. I got the poop stick. Come here.
Write that Christmas carol. I don't want to hear it. But in any case, that's my piece about Saucy Joe and the poop sticks.
That was great. I love that.
Yeah.
I do wonder, though, if mistletoes became popular, because they grow on trees, right?
Yeah.
And you said that they could grow on pine trees.
Sure.
Do you think someone was just trying to make a few extra bucks and was like, he cut down the pine tree, he was selling it, he was like, hey, mistletoes, you know, it's like chicken wings. That's the leftover bits, but you season them nicely and then they're a feature.
It's possible. My personal theory is that given the timing of the Christmas holiday, you know, all the trees are starting to lose their leaves, but the mistletoe is still green and it's still very obvious. You know, it's a piece of green decoration that's left at a otherwise cold, barren time of year. So it makes sense that it would have some kind of special celebratory significance because of that.
All right. That makes fair. It's just what they had to work with.
Yeah. Yeah. It really stands out in December. And it makes sense that like the only two pieces of greenery left in December, at least in this part of the world, managed to become indoor decorations during Christmas. The evergreens and the mistletoe.
Yeah, you know what? That does make sense, yeah.
But that's mistletoe, man.
All right, that was super cool. I like how you tied it to Christmas. Mine was just kind of based on, it's got it in the name, happens around Christmas time.
Hey, that's enough for me, honestly.
Yeah, there's not a ton to work with here.
It's literally in the name. You had me at Christmas. Anyway, what are you thinking about for the next episode?
You know, I got thinking, like, we have never done fungi before.
Oh, okay, yes, yes.
Have we?
We might have, but even if we have, let's do it again.
I don't think we've done it. I don't think so. I got nothing, personally, but...
Neither do I, but I can find so many cool things I know I can. So, I'm all about that. Let's do a fungi episode.
All right, sounds good.
All right. With that decided, do you want to take us out?
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a like or review on your podcast app of choice. And if you have a suggestion for a future episode, you can reach us at SoupPotPodcast on Twitter or theprimordialsouppot@gmail.com.
All right. And until next time, I'm Rustin.
And I'm Aaron.
See ya.